Welcome, everybody. How are you doing? This is Dave. Who's here?
Hi, it's Kathy from Ontario.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm good, and I apologize. I was a little late last week, but I really was. I did tap in, so I was on.
Okay, well, super. How are you finding the seminars so far? Are they useful in what you had hoped and find beneficial for your work, your practice?
For me?
Yes.
Well, I'm the crazy one that said she needed to get off the fence. And basically, I've really sort of pushed myself to get off that fence and sort of back out into mainstream here. And sometimes I'm thinking, and even in the last 2 weeks, there's been, it's just coming at me in all different directions of such a need. And when I really have this vision of what needs to go to the next step, it's like all around me, and it's saying, just trust.
Uh-huh.
You know, the timing is right, and the energy has come back from where it was when I left work, and I have to be careful because I need the balance, then that I don't get into the same story I was into before, but because I deal with environmental allergies and multiple, all this crazy stuff. But anyway, it's kind of all over the place saying to me, there's just signs all over the place saying, it's safe to get off the fence.
Well, coaching is different than counseling and therapy, and as a professional coach, we're professionals, but it's also a business, and that's quite different. I had a transition from practicing psychiatry and psychoanalysis for 25 years when I made the move to become a mentor coach, and one of the things that was the greatest challenge is that my mentor coach drugged me kicking and screaming into marketing, and you mentioned also part of being on the fence was not really knowing how to do marketing and knowing what
exactly you
needed to do in terms of marketing your business. So that's what I'm hoping to begin to address here in terms of
exactly some
practical ways to think about that and to approach that.
And I think that's why when the first week that I came on board, like I've been, you know, sitting here looking at this part of the coaching, and to go back and start all over again and do the complete, you know, I just don't think that's where I'm being called to do, that the coaching is what I've been doing. I've been labeled as the encourager. I've been the person that has seen people from the pit back into and have had to let go from trying to be the fixer to being
yeah.
on that other side. So,
you're transitioning into a full-time coaching practice?
Well, part-time is what I would like.
Okay, got it. Right.
But in that, but I think there's definitely a connection to what there will be in the whole parish nursing role. Like, I don't want to give up my nursing part because I'm really finding that there's a massive need here of bringing the health and faith together. And sometimes it's just the encouragement not to go one extreme to the other in the process. But there's a whole opening that's just starting out here at the moment of recognizing that it's bringing together, and I've been, like, within the last 10 years and as being off and whatever, has been working with Emmanuel College, working at being, like, a facilitator to establish the programs and have it that we can do it through technology instead of having to travel to Toronto. And I've been given the opportunity now in September to come forward and really go out there and market to a presbytery, which is now sort of like, I don't know if you can picture Canada, but in that it's like a 100-mile span of all of these churches under one presbytery that
uh-huh.
is opening up into, you know, realizing the old way isn't working, but this is the new way. And so I don't know if it's marketing as much to say I'm going to go out and have to be a coach to and to the actual parishioners, or the bigger picture is actually this next piece of the puzzle of educating and coaching and encouraging these individuals that are at this next level that I've been behind the scenes building up and working that I haven't got paid for, but on the other hand, seeing the reward, seeing the, just see, like, just seeing where they were and where they're going to in the professional.
Okay.
So I see workshops. I see rekindling the spirit that's dead.
Okay.
A lot of people.
Okay, well, great. And we're going to be talking today about charging what you're worth. So that could be
helpful.
That
would be really good.
What you just mentioned. So thanks for the input. Other responses, other questions, things that you'd like to discuss briefly before we move into the material from others? Anyone else? Questions, clarifications, things that have come up that you'd like to elaborate a bit about? Or have me elaborate about? Well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode then, and that will mean we'll have a bit more time preserved at the end for discussion. So jot down any questions or comments that you have. I'll put us on lecture mode. We're going to be talking in this seminar about fees, and particularly the professional fees that you're charging to be sure that you're charging what you're worth. I want to give you two initial quizzes to think about. And the first quiz is from the Wharton School of Business. They surveyed several thousand professionals to examine the major factor that determined whether someone would engage or decline professional services. And it's the same answer for both. The same reason that someone would accept your professional services or reject your professional services. So which of these do you think has the highest impact on their decision? Years of experience, reputation, amount of the fee, degrees and certifications, stating the recommendations and fee clearly and confidently, or state of the economy? Jot down your answer. Second quiz. Carnegie Mellon did a large study to determine the major factor for professionals earning the trust of others. Here are the options. An established, proven expert, confidence of the professional, demonstrated current expertise, or reputation. The answer for both is confidence. How you state your recommendations and your fee. Confidence is more correlated in a number of neuroscience studies with success in business than competence or expertise. Now, I'm going to elaborate a little bit about the stating your fee clearly and confidently. First, the clarity. The credibility of professionals is hurt if they're fuzzy about fees. It damages the trust the client has. For most people, the issue isn't whether fees are high or low, but that the professional is clear, direct, and specific about recommendations and fees. This is more important than the amount of your fees or any of the other variables that I mentioned, especially in the Wharton School of Business study. So, no matter how capable you are, clearly and specifically discuss your fees for the client to engage. The second factor is confidence. And my recent blog, I've mentioned this before, the most recent blog I have on my website, MentorPath, is about confidence. Confident is a state of mind. I won't reiterate any of that here, but recommend that you look at it if you're interested. A huge factor is that the professional is confident in stating fees. And here's what I think is an explanation for the need to be confident. A subliminal language of confidence. In other words, we communicate from midbrain to midbrain, energy field to energy field with someone. And when they sense or feel that we're confident in ourselves and in our recommendation, they want to sign on because they want part of that. They want to engage that confidence, to internalize it for themselves. Now, here's an example of how this can make a difference. A series of studies was reported by Dr. Dan Gilbert of Harvard, who showed that volunteers who were shown words on a monitor, on a computer screen, for a few milliseconds had an impact. They were shown a word that was, it was like subliminal programming. It was shown for 1/50th of a second. This was such a short time that they were unaware that the words were shown, couldn't even pick them out or guess from a multiple choice, yet they were influenced by them. For example, when the word hostile was flashed, volunteers judged others more negatively. When the word elderly was flashed, volunteers walked more slowly. When the word stupid was flashed, volunteers would perform less well on tests. Now, when these volunteers were asked later why they judged or walked or scored the way they did, they didn't know, but they never said they don't know. They quickly considered what they were aware of and came up with some reason. For example, the volunteers who walked more slowly first denied it. They said, well, no, I didn't. And then they were shown the before and after. And then they came up with reasons like, well, I was a little tired when I did the test, or, well, I've been traveling for the last few days and I haven't slept well. Even when they were told that there was subliminal programming and that the words appeared on the computer screen, they denied that it had an impact and still stuck with their explanation. Each was unaware of the fact that they were falsely attributing cause and effect. Now, these findings demonstrate the desire we have to bring closure, for our brains to end any dissonance, and for our minds to create a complete story by a cause and effect relationship. Even if this causal relationship is not accurate, it infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness to be able to explain. Then confirmation bias comes into play. We cherry-pick reasons to support our belief and become blind to data that refute it. So think about how you want to experience a presentation you attend. You want the speaker to be comfortable, to be confident, not distracting by being uncertain or hesitant or nervous, not self-indulgent by talking about all the work to put it together. It would interfere with your immersion, your total experience. This is also what your client wants from you, to experience you experiencing confidence while you're speaking clearly and engaging the client for what the client needs and wants. It's not about you. The client does not care what all you put into your background, your experience, your education. They want to know what's in it for them. You know, no patient ever was interested in the 25 years I practiced psychiatry and psychoanalysis. No patient was ever interested or ever knew about, did I finish first in medical school class, or was I named to one of the top psychiatrists in the country? They didn't care about that. That was for me. For them was I going to help them? No coaching client in the last decade, no mentor coaching class, has any concern or care that I've written 17 books. They want to know what's in it for them. What are the issues that we address as coaches for them? It's about them. With clarity and with confidence. If they don't perceive that confidence from you, the value you bring, but instead sense an uncertainty, it's going to light on something that will seemingly make sense to the client. Now, here's the result of how that can sound. Well, I'm on a schedule bind right now, so I'm going to have to put off starting our coaching till the fall. Or, well, I know I need coaching, but I just don't have the funds right now. And the potential client will totally believe what he's saying. Here's another example. As an explorer, Columbus was a pretty average sailor by all accounts, but in one area, he was a genius. People believed in him. He projected a sense of confidence that was completely out of proportion to his means, a quiet and calm self-assurance. In fact, it was the same confidence usually shown by the nobility themselves. The powerful in the old-style aristocracies felt no need to prove or assert or sell themselves. Being noble, they just knew that they deserved more, and they asked for it. Columbus got full funding from the Queen of England to sail not one, but three ships on the basis of an idea And at that time, it was really a goofy idea, an eyebrow razor and an eyeball roller combined to find a new world. Yeah, right. But Columbus taught others to respond to him. How to respond to him? By believing in himself. I want to talk about fees and value perception. There are two key elements to people paying top dollar for coaching services, for your services. The first, the coach deserves it. This is met by excellent training, continued learning, experience, dedication, and earning it. The second, you have to ask for it. Asking for it, in my experience, in training and mentoring hundreds of other coaches, deserves some attention. It's up to you to set your own price. It will reflect what you think of yourself. Ask for less, and the world will not raise your price. People will assume this reflects your value. If I were to come to your door and tell you, I have a brand new BMW 535 parked in your driveway, and I'll take $8,000 for it, what would be your question? What's the matter with it, right? Or what's the matter with you, Kruger? And it probably wouldn't help if I throw in a free hot dog with pickles and root beer. Ask for your full value, and you send a signal that you're worth it. Even those who turn you down will respect you for your confidence. That respect will ultimately pay off in ways you might not imagine. Early in my career, when I was on the faculty in the Department of Psychiatry at Baylor College of Medicine, I often had lunch with Dr. Hilda Brook. She was a psychoanalyst who was the first, and for some time, the only person in the country to do serious clinical work and research on eating disorders. She'd ask about my skiing trips and tell me about skiing decades ago in the Black Forest when she had to walk up the mountain with her wooden skis and would be the only woman skiing. It was late in her career, and she was world famous, and the only two books in existence at that time on eating disorders were ones she had written. She charged one of the highest fees anywhere in the country at that time and had a full practice with a several-month waiting list. She told me one day at lunch that she had decided to go into semi-retirement and only see a few patients to spend more time on a collection of papers for her papers that she was going to put together for a book. So a couple of months later, we were having lunch. I said, Hilda, how's your plan to work on your book going? And she looked at me and said, well, Dave, I decided the best way to do that would be to double my fee. In 2 months, my waiting list doubled. Charge so that you're unambivalent about working with a client. If a client pays you less than you're worth, or takes a good deal more time than others, or you agree reluctantly to meet at some goofy time, like 8:30 on Tuesday evenings, you'll be ambivalent and it will reflect in the quality of your work. And remember, and I think this is hugely important, we offer a model to our clients of comfort with money, of how and who someone can hope to become. We are, in my view, obligated to charge a full, fair price for our services that accurately reflects the value to the client. Clients have this model to emulate and internalize to get paid what they're worth. We present money as a simple medium of exchange. Then, if clients attach complexity and emotionality to money, we can help them understand its simplicity. I want to give you a brief example of someone who taught me a really important lesson. Many years ago, when I was still practicing psychoanalysis, my policy was to adjust my fee on a yearly basis according to inflation. Since some analytic patients would see me for 2 or 3 years for 4 times a week. This was a necessity. One patient was another professional who was just completing her training and starting her practice. She was having some initial startup struggles, and I knew I felt a little ambivalent about asking for a fee increase, even though my policy was to do it across the board for everyone. And I said to her, as I said to everyone else, I mentioned at the beginning, this is the beginning of maybe December for a January fee increase, I mentioned at the beginning of our work that I would adjust fees yearly on the basis of inflation. Beginning next month, I'll increase my fees by $5 a session. She paused. It was a long, pregnant pause. Then she said in a very metered voice, Kruger, if you say you need a fee increase in a way that's quieter than you usually speak, and in a halting way, as if you're embarrassed to tell me, how in the world do you expect that I can go out there and charge what I'm worth? If you can't say that you need $5 more each session in a way that's bold and confident and easy in the way you usually talk, what hope is there for me? Now, would you like to try that again? Of course she was right. And I did try it again. The same words, but this time in the way I did with every other patient. Her response was a very sweet, thank you. I'll be happy to pay you $5 more. Now, let's get on with my analysis. The world will not pay you for what you know. It will pay you for what you do. It rewards action. Analyzing, planning, thinking, and organizing are important, but you have to put it into action. If you divide the world, simplistically, into those who are successful and those who are not, the one thing that separates success is that they're the ones who have taken action. They develop a plan and set it into motion. It may not be perfect, but they self-correct, learn from their mistakes, and continue moving forward. They build momentum. Ultimately, they produce results. This may be why people with all kinds of advanced degrees can sit around and discuss things and plan something. And I've been on a board of directors in a startup like that, and sometimes not get a whole lot done. Meanwhile, the guy who barely finished the second semester of the first year of community college owns half the real estate on the west side of town. Let's talk about setting fees. This is a story told by a buddy of mine who's also a coach, Jed Niederer, at the beginning of his coaching practice. It's published in his book, Coach Anyone About Anything. One day, Jed's friend John said, you're so good at this recruiting and retention game, you ought to put on a seminar. You could teach other general agents and managers how to do what you do. I'd pay to learn what you do, and I'm certain everybody else in town would too. Now, remember, this was about 1990. So when I'm talking about fees, I'm talking about $1990. So Jed and his colleague Bill designed a two-day workshop and began inviting agency managers and supervisors to attend. One of the first people Jed called was his friend John, who had suggested the workshop. John said, it sounds great, and I'd love to come, but not for $150. And Jed said, well, you know, John, since it was your idea, John interrupted. He said, I'll come for $500. And Jed said, excuse me? John said, you know, I'd come for $500, but not for $150. For $150, it can't be worth my time. But for $500, I know there has to be value there. Jed reflected on that experience and the responses he got from people who would say, $500? Man, you must be really giving people the goods in that seminar. With both the time value of money and increased value of his seminars, Jed's prices are significant multiples of that now. The primary reasons that coaches don't charge what they deserve, fear of rejection, low perceived value of their services, and inexperience in setting and collecting professional fees. So here are some common mistakes that I see in professional fee setting. One, setting fees based on your peers. Most coaches have fees that are too low or that are outdated, may have different expertise than you, may not be as good as you, may not be in a different niche. Two, setting fees based on not seeing yourself as an expert. Perceived value is based on attribution of certain qualities. What do you assume when you see somebody who has a very high fee? A common perception is that they're an expert. People must have thought Hilda suddenly got twice as good. Three, determining your fee based on where you live. If you have a website, a blog, or an article, then you attract clients or a telephone, then you can work with clients all over the world. If you work by telephone, you have an international venue. Even the people here in Houston, I work with by telephone. And they recognize very quickly they don't have to get in their car and schlep across town, park, wait, do the same thing at the end. They close the door of their home or office, have privacy, confidentiality, and can purely immerse themselves in their work. Geography should have nothing to do with setting your fees. Your fees should not be determined by the average price of homes in your neighborhood, or if you live in Manhattan, or the average income of the ranchers in Reynolds County, Texas. Determine your fees based on value rather than price. Value is both monetary and intrinsic. If you devalue your service, you devalue the results that you expect and will get from your clients. So you are doing your clients a disservice. You cannot determine what your clients can afford. And listen carefully to this statement. If someone says they can't afford you, that's the person who most needs your services. Another reason. 4, a false belief is that you will not be able to help those in need if your fees are too high. Too high is relative. Affordability is your projection onto a client. In fact, as I mentioned, I don't think you'll be able to help clients as much if your fees are too low. A man approached J.P. Morgan, held up an envelope, and said, "Sir, in my hand I hold a guaranteed formula for success, which I will gladly sell you for $25,000. This was almost a century ago, remember. "Sir," J.P. Morgan replied, "I don't know what's in the envelope. However, if you show it to me and I like it, I give you my word as a gentleman that I will pay you what you ask." The man agreed to the terms, handed over the envelope. J.P. Morgan opened it, extracted a single piece of paper. He gave it one look, just a mere glance, and then handed the piece of paper back to the man and wrote him a check for $25,000. On the entire page, there were two sentences. "Every morning, write a list of things that need to be done that day. Do them." 5, keeping your fees low until you're certified, you have more experience, you're an expert, you're a bestseller, or you have a sufficient number of clients. Charge what you charge from the beginning. 6, deciding in advance that clients won't pay. We don't have the right to decide what people can and can't afford. This is a representation of the coach's money story rather than the client's, a part of your story projected onto the client. 7, over-delivering. Here's how that can look. Sessions run over, overly available to clients, afraid to raise fees, compensating for self-doubt about value or fee. Each of these mistakes has its own set of beliefs and behaviors. You can change any of them. I want to borrow two principles from New Life Story Coaches Training and New Money Story Mentor Training. 1, whatever you think, feel, and experience is what you create each moment. In other words, it's not there until you create it. And secondly, in adulthood, whatever you experience, you either create or accept. And a couple of things that are strong recommendations, although I don't think they're mistakes necessarily. I think that it's much better to charge a monthly retainer because that more reflects the nature of the work that we do as coaches, not per session. Because if you charge per session, you have a lot of accounting to do. You have to keep up with things. You have to send an invoice. The patient, the client has to very patiently wait for that invoice and then send you a check or pay online. And it just doesn't reflect the nature of the work we do. Think about, you go for a massage. 45 minutes, you're out of there, you don't think about it again. That's piecework. You don't do piecework as a coach. You engage in a process, and you encourage your client to think about and do work in between time. That client has, as an organizer, that standing time that you meet each week. There may be things that you offer in addition, such as email or brief calls in between sessions, sending material, Each of these are things that I offer my clients. And that means that your fee as a monthly retainer can more accurately reflect the nature of that process. And when you set a monthly retainer and have a standing time, which I'd also recommend, people just don't miss. Because think about if you have a per-session charge, you don't want a client to think about it in that way to start with. But if you have a per-session charge, you're going to have a cancellation policy most likely. Let's say you have a 24-hour cancellation policy. So a client is having a really tough time dealing with what they're dealing with. It's a painful process, and they are not looking forward to the next set. And if they cancel 24 hours in advance, you just double their resistance because they get to save that $225 that they're going to be paying you for that session or whatever you're charging. So you double their resistance. And when people do a monthly retainer, do an online payment, for example, set it up with something like PayPal where they fill out the information and it's automatically charged each month until they unsubscribe or until you stop, then it's not an issue. You've set it up. You've attended to the business part. You can now think about other things, the things that you want to think about and the client wants to think about. Now, let's look at behavioral economics applied. And if there are questions about this, I'll be happy to address them as we enter our discussion. Behavioral economics is the study of the social, cognitive, and emotional factors underlying economic decisions of individuals and groups. Behavioral economics studies how people really think and behave as opposed to how they think they think and behave. There are some lessons to apply behavioral economics to your coaching business. One, make a product's cost less painful. According to economic principle, the pain of payment should be identical for every dollar we spend, but this isn't the case. For example, we regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained. Found money can be consumed frivolously. Gifted money, spent pretty much without debate. Salary or professional fee money, after pretty serious comparative choice. Savings or retirement, only with definite need or emergency. This is a framing bias that money is treated differently based on its context. In marketing practice, many factors influence the way consumers value a dollar and how much pain they feel on spending it. When someone can delay payment, it can dramatically increase their willingness to pay. It also fits with their cash flow to make monthly payments rather than all upfront payments. So, some simple suggestions. Instead of a lump sum payment, divide the payment of an ongoing series, for example, that spans 3 months into three equal payments on registering, once on registering, once in 30 days, and once in 60 days. For your coaching fee, a monthly retainer paying in advance, not 3 months up front. And that way, when you have a recurring charge from an online payment, someone pays the monthly retainer for the month it's going to come, and then they're charged again for the next month. So you both get a record of the transaction. You get an accounting. You don't have to do anything. It's automatic both ways. Two, use the power and convenience of a default option. A continuity program means that when somebody signs up for your services or product, you can set the online payment schedule to be automatically recurring, which is what I'm saying. The same amount, the same date of each month until they unsubscribe. This works great for coaching services, including coaching groups. It's convenient for both you and the client. You don't have to send invoices. The client doesn't need to keep records and send the check. The automatic billing account is an automatic online record and receipt. Three, minimize the number of choices. Somebody can get overwhelmed with the number of choices fairly quickly. In one classic study, a gourmet grocery store offered a chance to taste 6 jams, while shoppers were offered on alternate weekends a selection of tasting 24 jams. They were all equivalent in price and value. The purchase rate when only 6 jams were offered was 10 times greater than the larger number of jams. Choice overload can lead to decision paralysis. Think about this when you offer options for your services or products. I would say no more than 3 options at most if you're talking about services. My preference is when I do a brief conversation with someone and make a recommendation for coaching, I will recommend a number of things. For example, I'll recommend that they fill out the client information packet on my website. Before I had a website, I just sent it as an attachment in an email. That they do a monthly retainer fee payment from the link I send, and I explain what it includes. After I've made a recommendation about coaching, about meeting on a weekly basis, and describing very briefly in a sentence or two what that would entail, and then the specifics of meeting and payment and that sort of thing. Make it very, very simple so that you can then talk about what the client may be interested in. 4, position your preferred option strategically. For those of you who have more than one option, economic theory says that everything has a price and your willingness to pay depends on that ultimate price. Not so, says behavioral economics. How you position a product can make a difference. For example, when you offer a client 3 options for coaching packages, the majority, about 80%, will pick the middle option. So be sure that's the one you want them to pick. Now, I'm not recommending having coaching options. I don't particularly myself think it's a good idea, because think about when you go to any other professional. You go to a doc, a dentist, an attorney, a financial professional. They don't offer you 3 options, and one option you get to do more emails or talk to them a little more often. They'll listen to your story, to what you want to do, and they'll make a professional recommendation. That's exactly what I think we need to do as coaches. Now, here's a little bit of information about calculating coaching fees. The question of the amount of fees consistently comes up as I mentor coaches and other professionals, so I want to mention it briefly. In addition to the marketplace, there is a formula for determining your coaching fee. And there are only 3 variables, if you think about it. Yearly income, number of clients, and amount of fee. Now, I want to simplify this by saying, let's just talk about individual clients. Now, I know you know that there are a lot of things you can do to leverage your time and impact. And that's doing coaching groups, mastermind groups, having products and services that are exponential uses of your time. But let's make this simple. So these are the 3 variables. You can pick any 2 of these that are the most important variables for you personally and professionally, then calculate the 3rd. For example, to determine the amount of your fee, choose the other 2 and then calculate. If you decide you want to make $200,000 a year in your coaching practice, and you want to work 11 months a year, and you want to see 15 clients each on a weekly basis each month, then the calculation is simple. You need to charge each client a monthly retainer of $1,215. Now, 3 suggestions about your fee. 1 is, don't set a fee that ends in big fat zeros. Instead of $600 a month, make it $625 or $575. It's perception, granted. But if it's not right, there wouldn't be so many items for sale at $9.95 rather than $10. Secondly, don't charge a monthly retainer divisible by your frequency of sessions. If you meet with a client 4 times a month, don't charge $1,000. First of all, too many big fat zeros. But also, somebody's going to immediately do the math and say, man, that's $250 a session. That's a lot of money. $1,050 or $975 is not divisible by 4. That's what I started at 10 years ago. I started out, my initial fee was $1,050 as a monthly retainer. And as I mentioned, the 3rd thing, I advise against charging per session. A retainer more accurately reflects the nature of the work that we do, the engagement with our clients. It's different from therapy. It's different from a massage. If your client is reluctant to talk about something in the upcoming session, as I mentioned, and then he saves money, you've doubled their resistance. We'll discuss in the next seminar the different forms of coaching services in addition to individual coaching that can leverage your time, value, impact, and income. So let's talk about how to charge what you're worth and get it. Do you have difficulty charging a specific fee for something that's intangible? Our value is not the assessments and the technique of coaching. It's the magic that we co-create with our clients. We engage the ineffable, but we charge for our time. So some of the most common issues and challenges. Coaching is a process and not an end result. Another, deciding in advance that clients won't pay, as I mentioned. Another, deciding in advance that clients can't afford to pay. So let's look at specifically some money conversations. You set a professional fee and then believe that someone will not be able to pay it, so you feel less than confident or lower the fee. When you decide in advance that a client will not pay your full fee or that a client can't afford that fee, this is your story, not the client's story. You do not have the information to decide. You have projected a part of your shadow story onto that client. We can create our own internal conversation without it ever involving anyone else. That internal dialogue gives voice to both sides of the conversation, the wish and the fear, the obstacle and the desire, the old story and the new story, the desire for expansion and the limiting belief. Both sides make a story complete. But then if we hand one side of this conversation, like the fear or the obstacle or the limiting belief, to the other person, the client, we're stuck and they're stuck. For example, I don't think she'll be able to afford coaching. Then we fail to see both sides, what we believe and what we attribute to someone else, as the complete mirrored picture of ourselves. Another example of this duality was a recent workshop that I participated in. The subject was money and fees and coaching. The moderator announced, and this was an ICF chapter meeting, the moderator announced at the beginning that we could not openly discuss money and actual fees in any part of the seminar. And, of course, a couple of people were astonished and wondered why. And it was stated that because, according to the International Coach Federation, it would supposedly be price-fixing. Now, of course, as you might guess, I challenged this restriction, pointing out that the workshop was about money and fees, clarifying that we weren't determining any policy or fixing prices, only discussing aspects of professional fees and our dynamics and the issues about fees. Whereupon an attorney coach reiterated the ICF stipulation. So occasionally I'm reminded why I avoid politics and why I don't usually go to coaches' meetings. Money often mirrors the thoughts and beliefs about ourselves. Money becomes the ink blot of the Rorschach test. When our eyes look straight at it, there's only a design on paper. But when offered the chance to imbue the design with meaning, the interpretations are going to be as wishful and varied as the fantasies of whoever's looking at it. In the professional arena, with your work with clients, in other words, money is going to find its proxy in these issues. These issues are going to be ways that money may hitchhike. Boundaries, courage, desirability, over-delivering, guilt, value, and confidence. Each of these has its own behavior. Now, those that represent the past can be changed. With each issue, there's both a shadow belief with its own behavior as well as a potential breakthrough belief with its own behavior. For example, over-delivering may mean that you wink at a boundary and go over the scheduled time or collude to engage at a time in your evening or weekend that erodes your private personal time. Over-delivering leads to exhaustion and burnout, at times resentfulness. Over-delivering comes from a place of need or trying to please, as well as questioning self-worth. you will then attract those clients who are needy and demanding. And another aspect of this, and this is beginning in a sample session, beginning in any session and work that you do with a client, when you establish a boundary of time, it's important that you keep that boundary and do the work, guide the work to be completed within that time. And if you decide to go over on time, think about the model that you're establishing. If you go over or just wink at a boundary of time and meet instead of 50 minutes for an hour, 15 minutes, that model that that client is downloading from you is not going to work in the real world. Because that model is not going to work in the real world if they want to do the same thing with their mortgage payment or their apartment rent, to say, well, I'll just be a little bit late. It won't make any difference. I'll just go over the boundary a little bit. That won't work in the real world. What we do with our clients is, in my view, what we would ideally do with our children when they were growing up, for each of you who've had children, that we make the environment at home and all of the interactions and all of the behaviors things that will work in the real world. Because if they suddenly go into the real world and the things that they've been doing at home, having fits and getting their way or whatever it is, the things that work at home are what they're going to be doing in the real world. If they don't work in the real world, they're not going to have much luck. So to not feel that you ever quite do good enough is exhausting. Over-delivering and having high standards are not the same. I advocate to deliver more than the client expects, but not in the sense of over-delivering or trying to make up for something, but delivering more value. If you don't value your services, you can't expect anyone else to value them. Coaching skills include comfort with money, charging and collecting what you're worth. And I think this is really important, understand the first and most important person that you need to convince about your billing rate, setting and collecting professional fees, in other words, is yourself. Now, I want to close here to allow us plenty of time for discussion of this, because I suspect that there are things that come up that you'll want to raise questions about. But I just want to point out, before I move back to discussion mode, in the workbook, the exercises and work pages of this seminar are calculation of coaching fees and money cruise control. And I would recommend that you look at those and do a little bit of time working on both of those for you and for your practice. Okay, we're back in discussion mode. I'm interested in your take on this, your thoughts and discussion. If you'll manage the background noise with star 6 until you're ready to talk. So, questions or thoughts? Or things you'd like us to discuss a bit more? Anyone? How much does this make sense in terms of your coaching practice to you? Does this fit with some issues that you are dealing with or have addressed in your practice? And what else would you like to discuss? Anyone?
Well, it's Kathy again.
Please, go ahead.
Okay. So I think you're kind of hitting the nail right on the head of where I'm at and as we started this conversation in regards to this fee thing, because I'm coming from a nursing background where I went to work, got this salary, and this is where it was at. And, you know, and when you're talking the dollars that you're projecting or saying that coaches are worth in this process, it's and when you've been downsized because of being on a disability pension, you really do lose that self-worth of, you know, I've gone from, you know, like a large discrepancy of where I was to where I am and living at. And but one of the things that I think is really holding me back is one of the coaches that I have had or that's been along in this journey is saying, you know, basically that we should be giving our time freely. And this is what this person has done with me for a number of months and whatever as I've got back on track and moved on in my journey.
So may I interrupt you at times?
Sure.
I think that's exactly what I'm speaking of, that the model that you establish is what the client is going to download.
Exactly.
So your coach made a mistake, I think, by doing that because it makes it very difficult for you now to set and collect a professional fee, to see yourself as a professional, to charge and value what you're worth, and to do it with clients. So that's simply something that all you have to do is decide what you're worth, what fee you charge, and establish it for a client. So
but
that's easily changed behavior.
You think so?
You're writing your story every day as a blank page, whatever we think and feel and experience, or what we're creating each day. When you meet with a potential client and make your recommendations, including your fee, you're free to say whatever you want to say. You're free to make the recommendations that you think will best fit the client. I know, and I believe you know, that it will best fit the client to pay a fee that values what you're worth because they're not going to get anything out of it if you don't. I can promise you that.
Mm-hmm. And see, and that was one of the things.
There are studies that demonstrate that this fact that I'm speaking of, that when various kinds of professional engagements are done for free, the value is diminished and almost to a negative extent because of the download. While we're talking about things, consciously and logically, we're downloading the process of what happens, including how much you believe in someone. And that, I believe, is the most important thing that we can possibly give or be for our clients, is to believe in them. And first we have to believe in ourselves and our ability to help them, because whatever we talk about, they're going to be seeing and feeling and midbrain to midbrain communicating with us of how much we believe in them, and they're going to live out that to be true.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us another, this is Myra, can you give us another an example of calculating the fees?
Well, you can, the three variables I mentioned, you can figure anything you want. If you decide what you're going to charge and how much you're going to work, then you can calculate how much you're going to make a year. The two I picked are ones that if you decide what you want to make and how much you want to work, then you can calculate what the fee needs to be if you only see individual clients for that. So you can pick any two of those and play with the numbers and see what you get. Now, is that what you're asking?
Yeah. For example, if I'm thinking I only want to work 9 months out of the year on this,
okay,
and I decide how much I want to make in that nine-month period. Say, just for an example, $5,000, just small example. So
it's a small example and a small number, and I think you're minimizing your work.
Okay.
I think in 9 months you should make more than $5,000 on one client.
Okay.
Why not? You know, why wouldn't you make several hundred dollars an hour?
There's no reason not to.
You're
other
right.
Other than the fact that, like the other lady just said, that's not, maybe because we just aren't accustomed to that. That's
well,
a mindset.
That's true. You're not accustomed to it, but the only reason that you won't make it is that you don't ask for it. So the issue is to get accustomed to it. So
okay.
Now, this is going to occur, and we've touched on this before. This is going to occur with every client you work with, and it's going to occur with you first. Whenever you do something new or change, that behavior is going to feel uncomfortable in the beginning because your mind is not accustomed to not knowing the outcome of the predictable and the same, the status quo, and your brain is going to register error detection, that you're not doing the thing that's accustomed to do, that the brain, out of an evolutionary perspective, has laid down tracks, pathways, and neuronal networks to make what you do in a usual way the default mode. So when you try something new, it's going to result in discomfort in the beginning. Now, the most common reason that people don't change is whenever they do make some behavioral change, they don't incorporate it as part of their identity. So we always revert back to our core identity. So your core identity needs to evolve with the changes you make so that you have to move out of your comfort zone and get to a position of doing something new and different, which may be setting and collecting professional fees commensurate with your worth, and dealing with the discomfort of it internally so that it doesn't show up with your client. One of the first things that happened when I was when I made my transition to professional coaching from being a therapist and an analyst, one of my very best friends flew to Houston to take me to dinner. He had made a similar transition. He was a senior executive at IBM. Out of 10,000 salesmen, he was number one. And he had made a transition into a consulting practice, and he was at that time making a few thousand dollars a day. And now he and I do some things together, and he makes $12,000 to $15,000 a day. But at the time, he said, Dave, do you know about the gulp factor? I said, no, Art, tell me about the gulp factor. He said, you charge as much as you can possibly say without gulping. And, you know, he said, and your gulp factor will increase over time. And of course, it has, and his has. So say as much as you can. I mean, think about the value you bring. There are four studies that show some value for coaching, that show a return on investment of an average of 6 to 1 in these studies. There are three from the Lore Institute, L-O-R-E, and one from Manchester Consulting that show the average, or the range is from 5 to 10 to 1. In other words, for every $1 invested, there's a return on investment of 5 to 10 fold, $5 to $10. So, and the average is 6. So every dollar invested, there's a return on investment, a benefit of $6. So the studies are there, the value is there. It's your comfort in charging what you're worth that I think it will be of value to your client first and foremost, and secondly to you.
Okay.
And I see people seriously undercharging for their coaching services. Any other? We got. Well, we're really out of time. If there are other questions, let's pick up right here next time, because I think this is important, and jot it down. And those, I know some of you mentioned to me that you're going to be listening on the recorded because you weren't able to come. So if there are questions, let me know, and we'll pick up right here next time before our last seminar and discuss this too, because I think this is important as well. So I hope you have a great rest of the week. Thanks very much for your participation, and I appreciate your kind words through the emails. If there are questions, jot them down, and we'll begin right here. Thanks very, very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
You bet. Bye now.